Welcome to Night Sky Tourist, a place to learn the night sky, have fun with its ancient stories, meet astronomers and dark sky advocates, and fall in love with the dark. I'm Vicki Dirksen, your host and author of the website and blog, nightskytourist.com. If you've never visited the website, I invite you to stop by after the podcast. Check out some of the great blog articles, browse through the resource page, and sign up for the newsletters. The newsletters have great content that is exclusive for subscribers. Are you ready for an adventure under the night sky? Let's jump right in. If you've listened to enough Night Sky Tours podcast episodes, you likely know that I'm a history geek and I love to learn about star stories from other cultures. Many years ago, as I spent time learning about ancient religions, I was struck by how much the cosmos played a role in their worldview. In some ways, it was a matter of survival. Knowing when it was planting season or time to harvest meant the difference between life and death for those ancient cultures. The only way to know when to plant their crops was to watch the night sky, which was used as a calendar. So, for example, the ancient Egyptians watched for Sirius to rise in the eastern sky right before sunrise. This let them know the Nile River was about to flood, which would bring in the rich nutrients that were needed for planting successful crops. The Arabic world spanned an area that we call the Fertile Crescent, and that's the land where civilization as we know it was born. The pre-Islamic Arab astronomers relied entirely on empirical observations, while their Babylonian, Greek, and Indian counterparts were busy using elaborate mathematical calculations to make sense of the night sky. The Arabic astronomers first concentrated on translating astronomical writings from other cultures, but it wasn't long before they were developing new ideas. We owe so much gratitude to Arabic astronomy, and I am thrilled to have a guest on this episode who has spent over 20 years researching Arabic astronomical traditions. Dr. Danielle Adams is a cultural astronomer who works at Lowell Observatory as the Chief Marketing and Revenue Officer. She studies the development and transformations of indigenous Arabian astronomy through pre-Islamic poetry and Arabic historical literature. Dr. Adams is active in informal astronomy education, and she speaks to various groups about Arabian cultural astronomy and the heritage of the many Arabic star names that astronomers still use today. She's inspired by the pristine desert skies to advocate for dark sky preservation. Please join me in welcoming to the podcast, Dr. Danielle Adams. Well, Dr. Danielle Adams, thank you so much for joining me on the Night Sky Tours podcast. I can't wait to talk about this subject.
It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm excited too.
I am so curious. What made you so interested in studying Arabic cultural astronomy? Because it's kind of a field or a topic that I really haven't heard a lot about. So how did you get into it?
The short version is that I was interested in astronomy since I was 7 years old and got my first telescope from my grandmother. And I've also been interested in other cultures and languages, and through a number of different circuitous events, I ended up smashing the two together. And so you get cultural astronomy is basically the anthropology of astronomy. So I'm not studying the stars themselves. I'm studying how people relate to the stars and how that impacts society and vice versa.
It's interesting though, because as I guess kind of the term today is, as European Americans, we're pretty familiar with, let's say, ancient Greek or Roman star stories or mythologies, but it seems like we're really clueless about the fact that some of those have even more ancient origins than we've thought. What can you tell us about that?
The sky we look at today is a mess. It's a combination of material from several different cultures. We have constellations with Latin names from the Roman Empire, but pictures that are largely Greek, but much of those were also borrowed or transferred, adapted into Greek astronomy from earlier Babylonian and Mesopotamian astronomies, especially the zodiacal constellations. In our modern sky, we have star names that mostly derive from Arabic. Of those, some of the Arabic names come from Arabic descriptions of Greek astronomy, which is basically Islamic astronomy, and then others are Arabic descriptions of indigenous Arabian astronomy. And that's what I am especially honing in on. So our modern sky is just a real mess. How I like to compare it is a flat sky, and it's artificially flat. And what I mean by that is, if you imagine yourself creating a image in Photoshop or some other image editing program, and you put a bunch of things together, when you save that image, you no longer see the layers that went into it. You only see the resulting pixels that were on top, and it's a flattened image. But much of cultural astronomy is multi-layered and textured and really messy. Things change depending on context or depending on who is talking about the star. And so things are not as we often have them in Western societies.
Yeah, I it's funny because it's just kind of, I think, the story of culture in general, isn't it? Like, you know, we think that we have these things that are so perhaps very American, but we don't understand that there's layers and layers of history prior to now, you know, that make up those things. And that's the kind of stuff that fascinates me so much. And it sounds like you're in the same boat.
Yeah, it's really neat diving in and, you know, investigating where these things come from. Even some things that appear to be, say, you know, Roman or Latin star names, when you dig into it, only look Latin because they were translated out of Arabic back into Latin. And as you dive deeper, you find, oh, hey, this is part of indigenous Arabian astronomy. It's really neat. And I like, in this field of study, it kind of helps build those bridges of understanding to other cultures. It's so easy for us, even now in 2023, for us to have exposure to just bad stereotypes of Arabs and Arab culture. And when you dig into this, you can see the richness of their culture in it. And I think it, you know, goes some way to help build those bridges of understanding.
Yeah, as I've looked back, even just the little bit that I've done of astronomical history, like you, I'm not an astronomer, so I don't really study like the composition of stars and things like that. I'm kind of more in the vein of you, of wanting to understand how it's impacted humanity. And that was one thing that I learned, is that so much richness came out of the Islamic study of the night sky centuries and centuries and centuries ago. And we owe a lot to what they learned, what they understood. And, you know, you mentioned that some of the star names, not just constellations, but some of the star names come from the Arabic language. Can you share some of that with us?
Yeah, absolutely. And as we go into this, it's important to separate out what is indigenous from what is Islamic. So pretty much Islamic astronomy adopted Greek pictures of the sky, but used indigenous Arabian star names. When you look back into the works of a Sufi, you'll see he was one of the first ones to create images with basically maps of the constellations and the stars in the constellations. And, you know, those are pretty much Greek pictures of the sky. There's a few things that change. The harp of Lyra becomes a turtle. Shellyak in Arabic, But it's pretty much the Greek sky pictures with indigenous names. You have to go back further to start uncovering really what the indigenous Arabian picture of the sky looked like before the introduction of Greek astronomy, which Islamic leaders then subsequently adopted as kind of the framework, the sky pictures. One good example of how this is all kind of interrelated and mixed up is in our summer triangle. And I know it's winter right now, but there's also some winter examples too. In the summer triangle that we use here in the US, that's Deneb in Cygnus the Swan, and Altair in Aquila the Eagle, and Vega in Lyra or Lyra, however you pronounce it, the harp or lyre. Of those star names, Deneb is an Arabic name, what we have left of an Arabic name that was originally Dzhaja, which is the tail of the fowl. And that describes the tail of what wouldn't have been seen as the swan for Islamic astronomy because there were no swans. It was more of a general fowl or chicken, but it's the tail. And that's basically the Greek picture of the sky. When we go to Vega and Altair, though, these are remnants of indigenous Arabian star names. Vega was originally An-Nasr el-Waqi'a, which means the alighting vulture, and Altair was An-Nasr el-Ta'ir, the flying vulture. And so they were together, the two vultures, because they set together into the western horizon at the same time. Waqi'a, meaning alighting onto a surface, like a vulture alighting onto some carrion, that came to us as Vega in Latin. We should be as a W, that's the standard for Latin, but we don't. And so that is now today Vega. And then Altair is really similar to the Arabic, Al-Ta'ir. You can hear those sounds there. So that's one example from the summer sky, and you can see star names that are indigenous and placed within Greek or Islamic constellation figures. And then another star name, Deneb, that is not indigenous. That is a really a description of the of one star's position inside the Greek figure.
That's all really fascinating stuff. And isn't it true? I've heard this, and you'll be the expert, so you can tell me if it's true. We have a lot of star names that start with the letters AL, so like Aldebaran and the such. Are those all Arabic star names?
Most of them will be, possibly all of them, but I can't think of all of them at this moment. Yes, AL is just the definite article in Arabic. It means the. So for Aldebaran, in Arabic, that's Adebaran, and the AL just means the. So it's the follower, is its meaning in Arabic. And it's the follower of Thuraya. Which is the Arabic name for the star cluster. They were engaged, and Adebaran was the male figure that was pursuing his beloved Thuraya across the sky. And then there's actually a bit of a love triangle in that another bright star in the region, which we call today Capella, which is not an Arabic name, but in Arabic, that bright star Capella was called El Aryuk, which means the impeder or the preventer. And so that star was preventing the two of them from getting together. So forever, Adebaran chases Athuraya, but never quite catches up to her.
And so Aldebaran is a star in the constellation Taurus, as we know it today, for people who are curious. There's also a star in the Big Dipper called Alcor. Is that also Arabic as well?
Yes, but that's stemming from an Arabic description of Greek astronomy. In there's a pair of stars, Alcor and Mizar, and they were used across many different cultures as a test of eyesight. In indigenous Arabian astronomy, one of the stars, the brighter one, was called El Anat, which is the she kid, a young female goat, and the fainter one was called a suha, which in Arabic means the overlooked one. So if you're not looking for that fainter one, that's a test of eyesight, you miss it. And so it was literally the overlooked one. So yeah, that's a good example of how we have, you know, a name in that's Alcor, but it's actually not indigenous. It comes from more modern.
I think it just goes to show us, you know, we're such an interconnected world, not just today in our modern times with, you know, economies and commerce and things like that, but even back in those days, centuries, you know, thousands of years ago, there was so much being shared between cultures. I just think it's so fascinating. And I love too that you brought up this eye test with these two stars, because I lead a lot of stargazing experiences for people. And I love to point up there at those two stars and ask people, can you see two stars? And not everybody can. And so I talk about how, you know, that used to be used as an eye test. And I like to tell it to them as it was used as an eye test for the Roman army. So if you couldn't see the second star, you couldn't be the equivalent of a sniper. You had to be out front. You're going to die faster.
In the Arabian sense, we have just a little quote without much context. But it seems to have been somehow connected to people in love, because there was a saying that says, she shows me the moon and I show her the overlooked one. So the sense there that oftentimes women's faces were compared to the beauty of the full moon. So she shows him the moon, and, you know, somehow through his prowess, probably his skill in having good eyesight, shows her the overlooked one.
That's really fascinating. I love how cultures around the world created stories to like tell their origin stories, or to maybe teach, you know, moral object lessons to their people. And the sad thing to me today is that we've lost so much of the sky with light pollution, but it's so great to go out and to, you know, look at the stars, but to start to learn them and to learn some of these kind of stories that come behind them.
I think there's a really strong connection between cultural astronomy and our modern work on preserving and even restoring the dark skies, because a lot of the stories that you encounter in cultural astronomy wouldn't exist if their skies had been bright, like our skies. So I'm here in Flagstaff, Arizona, the world's first international dark sky city. We've got great dark skies. You can see the Milky Way from downtown. And I can show people who come to Lowell Observatory or, you know, other contexts, I can show them in the sky, even the faint stars that make up elements of the different stories. But I couldn't do that, say, in Phoenix or in, you know, other large light polluted cities. So, you know, I think there's a really strong connection where if we can tell these stories of the ancient skies, which are necessarily darker skies, that can help us recover something in our fight against light pollution.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, it's the same as anybody who has maybe as a family relocated from one culture into a completely different culture, you know, how devastating would it be to lose that connection to the culture that you came from? And in a sense, that's kind of what we have going on with light pollution, is that loss to our heritage with the night sky. And so I'm really grateful that there are people out there working on things like that. So I'm curious, do you have like a really great Arabic star story that you can share with us?
There are a lot of star names in Arabic that survive, you know, several hundred of them, but there are not a lot of stories. However, one that is from our winter sky is a pretty interesting one. In this story, we have a young woman named Al-Jozat, and she is basically the three stars in the belt of Orion. in Arabic, al jawzat has a meaning that has something to do with being in the middle of two other things. And so if you look at that line of three stars in the belt of Orion, they're almost equidistant and almost perfectly symmetrical. So that's al jawzat. And she was betrothed to Suhail. And Suhail is the second brightest star in the sky. In modern astronomy, we call that star Canopus. And Suhail had two sisters. They were called Ashariyan, which doesn't translate very well, but they were the two Shara sisters. And the story goes that on their wedding night, something happened, and there, but by morning, Al-Jawzat was dead. And so Suhail feared for his life and fled far to the south. And that is why Suhail, the star that we know today as Canopus, is so far to the south. Now, his two sisters did two different things. One sister just cried and cried until pus filled her eyes, staying at home. And that star is a bright star, but not the very brightest of stars. And that star is today a Procyon. And it's a bright one, but she's crying with pus in her eyes. And her Arabic name is Ashara al-Ghumaysat, which means the little bleary-eyed Ashara. Her sister decided to take action and crossed over the river to be closer to her brother, Suhail. And that one is called Ashara al-Abor, the Ashara who crossed over. And we know that star today as the brightest star in the whole sky, Sirius. Now, the river she crossed over is the Milky Way. And if you look at the sky today, Sirius is on the western edge, which from our perspective in the northern hemisphere is to the right or below right, depending what the aspect is in the sky of the Milky Way. But interestingly, Sirius is so bright because it's very close to us. And so it has a quite large proper motion, which makes it move over long periods of time against the background of stars that are much further away from us. And so if you go back 50,000 years ago, Ashara al-Abor really was on the other side of the river, the Milky Way, from our perspective here on Earth. Now, this doesn't mean that the story is 50,000 years old. Certainly, the star could have been imagined to have been in the process of crossing the Milky Way at any point in the last thousands of years. But it's a pretty neat coincidence that that star really did cross over the Milky Way over the last 50,000 years.
That's so fascinating to me because, you know, we think of the stars as being kind of fixed in their positions in the sky, and yet, you know, they really aren't. It's just that the time that it takes for them to move is so long that I don't think we really think about that. That's absolutely remarkable to think of.
Yeah. And, you know, that connects to you know, a feature of certainly indigenous Arabian astronomy, but many other cultural astronomies around the world, is that the stars were learned in connection to their place in time and space and their connection to the horizon. Today, when we learn modern astronomy, whether you're a professional or an amateur astronomer, a lot of that is learned without any connection to the horizon. Most of the books just show, you know, grids with a right ascension and declination coordinates, and this is a constellation, and these are where the stars are in relation to each other. And that really disconnects us from their motion through space as we see it from our perspective on Earth. And that was a connection that was really very strong in indigenous Arabian astronomy.
So if someone was really interested in digging deeper into this topic of Arabic cultural astronomy, where would you direct them to go?
So I'm working on this. There's not a lot of material that is presented from within the Arabian context. You'll see different bits here and there in some, various books about constellations or star names. But I'm in the process that'll present this from within its own context. For now, I have a website that I developed as part of my NASA space grant when I was working on my PhD at the University of Arizona, and that is at onesky.arizona.edu.
Thank you for doing that. That's awesome. How can people find you online?
If you go to lowell.edu, you can find me in the staff directory and feel free to reach out, send me an email.
Awesome. I will put the link to that in the show notes and to the other website you mentioned so that people can just easily click on it and go see your stuff. So Dr. Adams, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It's such a fascinating topic, and I know that you probably have hours worth of stuff you could talk about, but we're going to respect your time, and thank you so much.
Absolutely, Vicky. Thanks so much, everyone, for listening.
If you love cultural astronomy, you'll want to check out a couple of past Night Sky Tourist episodes. In episode 9, I chat with Dr. Anthony Aveni about his research in Mayan archaeoastronomy and how he helped develop the field of archaeoastronomy in the Americas. I had the great privilege of interviewing Dr. Aveni just 2 weeks after he appeared on Neil deGrasse Tyson's Star Talk Radio. The other episode you'll want to hear is episode 5, where I chat with Luke Edens about cultural astronomy. We focus on great sites that you can visit in the American Southwest, but the conversation is a great launch pad for exploring other great cultural astronomy sites. Listen to Dr. Anthony Aveni at nightskytourist.com/9 and Luke Edens at nightskytourist.com/5. But honestly, the easiest way to find them is to go to the show notes and click on the links there. One question I hear frequently these days is how people can see the comet that's currently zipping through our solar system. I've asked Ted Blank to join me in answering some questions, and Ted is a NASA Solar System Ambassador, and he was also the guest on our very first episode of Night Sky Tourist. And he's been a subsequent guest on our episodes as well. And he's also done a lot of Q&As for our listener questions. So Ted, thank you for joining us again.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
So here's some of the questions that I hear. And it's interesting to me because there's so much media buzz about it. So can you start by just telling us what is the comet and why is there so much buzz about it?
Sure. Comets are visitors to the inner solar system. They are made up of ice and rocks, and typically they orbit the sun in very elongated orbits. Most of the time they spend far from the sun, out beyond even the orbort of Neptune, in something called an Oort cloud. But periodically they come in and swing around the sun and then head back out. The time between closest approaches can be a few years, a few decades, a few hundred years, or in the case of this comet that we're talking about today, about 50,000 years. That's how long it takes it to make one trip around the sun and approach us closely. The reason there's so much buzz about it is simply that it is big enough, bright enough, and close enough to Earth that people can see it in reasonably small optical aids like binoculars. And possibly, if you are like a park ranger in Yosemite Valley or the Grand Canyon, you'd be able to go out and glimpse it naked eye in the dark, dark skies. But typically people will need at least a pair of binoculars of any size to be able to see it, and a map like the one that you can find at Sky and Telescope's website for free. It'll show you exactly where it is. And it's easy to find in the sky because it's very near the Big Dipper and Little Dippers and the North Star Polaris. So there are a lot of good landmarks in the sky that make it easy to find.
So that's one of the questions that I get a lot is, if, you know, people asking, can I see it with my naked eye? And so you've said it just really depends on where you are and if you know where to look. I know that you have spotted it already. What was your experience? What did you actually see when you saw it?
I saw it in a pair of binoculars, 8x42 binoculars, so reasonably small ones that you would use for bird watching. And to me, it was the faintest possible little fuzz ball, kind of like a little cotton ball in the sky, but very, very faint and gray and just visible above the background light, even here in our reasonably dark skies of Fountain Hills. There's a lot of talk about it being the Green Comet. This comet happens to have a lot of carbon in its nucleus or core, and that carbon emits a green light when it's excited by light rays from the sun. But that's a very faint light. And so you might be able to see that in a telescope of, say, 6 inches or larger. But it's also possible to see it if you have a smaller telescope, but attach a camera to it and allow the camera to take a long exposure, like a 30-second or 1 minute exposure of the comet. Many of those photographs are published on the web right now. It's not like you have to go out and buy a telescope and a camera to do this. Just go on Google and search, and you'll find tons of pictures of this beautiful green glowing coma, which is the gaseous envelope that surrounds the nucleus of the comet. It's a beautiful sight, and you'll see also pictures of several of the tails of the comet that go off in different directions. Some of those tails are influenced by the radiation pressure from the sun, and others are influenced by the magnetic fields, so they point in different directions.
You know, you've touched on something that I think is really important for people to know, because I'm always about managing people's expectations when they go out to do stargazing and stuff. You know, a lot of people are going to see these images of this green comet and these multiple tails, and it's beautiful. It's very stunning. But I tell people that's not what you're going to see when you look through a telescope, because as you've already mentioned, it's either long exposure photos, or sometimes they take hundreds of photos and stack them on top of each other in order to get that amazing, vivid detail. And so that's not to discourage people from going out and trying to see it themselves, because there's something spectacular about looking at things in the night sky and seeing it with your naked eye. But people need to manage their expectations. They're not going to see those images that they're seeing online.
That's correct. But of course, the excitement for me is the fact that this is a visitor from the outer solar system. And it's moving through our inner solar system so fast that from night to night, it will be in a different place in the sky every time you look at it. So you're becoming part of the knowledge base that says that our solar system is an active place. And by the comet being bright enough to see in a reasonable pair of binoculars, you can participate in understanding that we live in an active universe, that these comets are constantly traversing our solar system, even though we can't see them. But once in a while, when one is bright enough to see it, we can enjoy the knowledge that we understand a little bit about what's going on. And you're a part of that knowledge by being able to see this comet change position night after night and get an idea that, this is really a visitor from the outer reaches of our solar system. And we won't see it again for another 50,000 years or so.
Ted, thank you for joining us again. Thanks for sharing with us about this super cool visitor from outer space.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining me for another episode of the Night Sky Tours podcast. If you enjoy the Night Sky Tours podcast, please show your support by subscribing to it in your podcatcher and leave a written review. Your reviews are really important to me, and they help others discover the podcast. Be sure to visit nightskytourist.com for great articles and resources. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter for exclusive content. We'll see you here again in 2 weeks. Until then, keep looking up.